domain of these coils, the width of the coil is just a few millimeters, so let's say to 1/8 or 2/8 of an inch. They are very tall, and the spacing is exactly the same, and you have plenty of them. So, Dick said to decrease the capacitive component. So, they wanted to decrease the capacitive for the component, but at the same time, they wanted to amplify with the ferrite. Is that correct?
Wesley, I know that if you look in your past emails that I've sent you, I sent you an email in the past, because remember I sent you something? So I looked up you and I sent you an email. I think you got that one, so you can respond to that email directly. And as far as the structure goes, it's hard to tell without until I really look at the structure, because sometimes they can be very confusing until you actually see it on paper, and then, you know, I can probably give you, you know, an intelligent, you know, idea of what and how it's coupling. QSL?
Yourself. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do appreciate very much your generosity and staying even longer than is required. And I don't have courage to hold you longer. So thank you very much for the conversation, and talk to you all down the road. John Pickup.
Yeah, good night, Glenn. 73. Thanks for participating. What are you
going to
do now, Wes?
Yes, 73s, guys. Have a good one. KC2QIQ.
Well, I was able to get so much from Glenn. With help of the Dick, and his questions, and his ability to express these questions, it was like I didn't have to ask one single question. I've got so much of help. Back to you, John.
No, that was great. No, the information was great tonight again, as usual. But now you got to figure out how you're going to do that and which road you're going to take. You got to make a couple of small samples up, even if you do it manually. Make a few, just see how it goes, use the different chemicals, and then you'll get a direction. And you'll be able to work something out, I'm sure, with that.
You know what, I think I found, I take the stick, which is the cylinder. I put the very thin rope, or let's say the, how do you call it, it's not the rope, it's very thin one. I'm missing the word, but you...
Cord or string?
A cord or string. I wind it the same fashion as if I would wind the winding from the copper wire. Then I brush it with that specific epoxy that Glenn mentioned and let it dry. Then it's gonna create the former. Now, because I still have that stuff on that cylinder, I use the lathe to give it the proper shape and the thickness. What do you think about it?
Yeah, that you could do that. And then what you could do is after you put the cord on and epoxy it, then let it harden because it'll have ridges on it. And then fill it in with another coat of epoxy, and maybe two coats, and then machine it down. That might work well.
Yeah, you're right. The only thing is that I have to purchase another lathe. I don't want to mess up with this lathe. I want to buy a very cheap wooden lathe, or something that has a variable speed. And then I wouldn't be worried about things.
I don't think you'd have to buy another lathe. Why don't you use the lathe only as the driving force, maybe as a belt or a strap coming off of the chuck, to turn another spindle you set up on another a cheap spindle, a window shade or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he uses only to make that winding from the string. Then take it out from the lathe, put it into the place, or even dip it with epoxy.
Well, you could do that, but you're probably better off as it's rotating on another device to coat it, because I don't think you'll get it to run off. You'll have to change the, you know, you'll have to hold it vertical for like 10 minutes, then turn it the other way, 180 degrees, to get it to be, for that epoxy to lay nice and smooth on there.
Takes a while.
Can you pick it up?
Joe Moore, I've only heard part of the conversation, but Wesley, if you're afraid of getting the lathe messy and dirty, why not cover the bed with plastic? And, you know, just shield everything and use the lathe you've got with a direct drive.
Yeah, that's another opportunity. The only thing is that then nearby the truck, and from the other side, when I have a live end on it, live sensor on it, I might just get it messy.
Coated with grease.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Thank you very much for the work.
So my next recommendation would be that you buy me another lathe, and I'll lend you my lathe to do it on high height.
I didn't get that, John.
Randy's recommendation was buy him a new lathe, and he'll let you use his old one.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Actually, the price of lathe is not a very high one. If you go to Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania, people are selling stuff for almost nothing. And, the history of everything that I have purchased is many times, 10 times less, or even more than 10 times less than the original price. That's how I buy the stuff. And everybody's happy. Thank you.
Are you speaking of the folks at Grizzly?
No, I don't like Grizzly. The Fox Shop is another name for Grizzly. I don't like them. See, Grizzly is long time on the market. They established the reputation. That's fine. They are the best from the Chinese crap, or whatever crap they have. I don't like them. But if it's something that is even Grizzly, but instead of paying $5,000 for it, you pay $500 for it, it's worth the effort. Thank you.
Oh, I understand. I agree with you on Grizzly. Grizzly tools are kit tools. You buy it as a kit, and hopefully you've got some metalworking tools to be, or some metalworking skills to be able to get it quite up to the par. I own a couple of Grizzly devices, and every one of them has been kind of kit form.
Well, as far as the lathe, I was dealing with Grizzlies when I had my wood shop, and I didn't like the stuff, but it was cheap and it did the work. As far as the lathe, there is not much apart from crappy workmanship to be not done properly. If you have a lathe and it's done from the cast iron, and you have a prism bed on it, the only what can go wrong with it is just very cheap craftsmanship, the workmanship on it. Other than that, it should be accurate. And Grizzlies, yes, Grizzly is cheap, but is one of the best from all of this crap that is. I mean, I said to myself, I would be very much careful if I ever buy another device from China. I have one. It's a frequency counter. It does the job. But before it does the job, you can fall asleep. Back to you.
Oh, I agree with you. My shop is a woodworking shop, and I, at this point, I've replaced all the Grizzly stuff. I've got one or two shop pucks, like sand. It's tough to make a difficult table. But at this point, I'm a big Jet fan, actually. I've got a number of Jet tools that I've been very pleased with. I also have a couple of Polish squares. I've got a Chuck from a company called Bison that is from Poland. And those I've been extremely pleased with as metalworking tools go.
Well, as far as this stuff goes, if you want to buy really something that is gonna survive your life and the life of probably few generations, is Knapp, K-N-A-P. What happened is, Knapp was a very good German company who made something for the hobbyist, but it was extremely, extremely good sliding table show. Actually, there was five machines in one, and Robland, which is the from Holland, I believe, or Switzerland, they bought Knapp with the shoes. And at that point, they were able to use at least part of that technology in their machine. I had Robland by myself. I purchased a new one. It was never like a Knapp. On the Knapp, you could see it with all weight that you have, and if you have it doesn't matter. On the one side of the sliding table saw, slide yourself on that table and took the micrometer to measure the deflection. Unbelievable stuff. Back to you.
Oh, I believe you. I have a friend through woodworking that has a Knapp. I also know a couple that have Roadlands, and the Knapp is a fine machine. I'm going to be out of range here in a minute, but my thoughts for you are you could definitely cover the bed of your lathe with plastic to protect it. You could also, if you can get some large pieces of cardboard, you could affix them firmly enough to the bed somehow, cut a hole in the center of it, and run the live center through that hole. So that way you're protecting all of your spindle, the actual end of the live center. If you have a live center with a longer cone that you don't mind the cone getting dirty, that you can clean, and as John says, you can probably grease it. So I think you could build a deflection shield that you run the live center through that would work for you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Especially if I'm running a very, very low speed, because I don't need a high speed for it, very, very low. So the former is barely turning. That's what I need. Yeah, that's a good idea. As far as the Knapp, well, I remember Knapp had the shaper, sliding table saw, the horizontal mill. Actually, it wasn't a mill. It was the one, the mortiser. There was a mortiser. And a few other things. So I put cheaper version that was Robland. Robland was good, but it was nothing that was even close to Knapp. Poland has a good machinery, wooden machinery, really good one. It's a Minimax from Italian guy. Well, these guys, they know how to make the sexy machine, sexy looking. But sexy doesn't mean good. Back to you.
Remember, those are the folks that brought you the Fiat. Fix it again, Tony. I'm out of range, guys. I got to go. Leslie, John, have a great evening. I'll catch you later. K2YO's clear.
Okay, 73, John.
73, have a great evening. Oh, Wesley, the only lathes I had and milling machines were South Bends, and needed riggers to move them when I had them. They were huge machines, but those were the kind of machines that you could turn out some nice work on. But everything has gone much lighter now. You don't need all of that heavy mass. And these machines do a very nice job. So I think you got what you need. I don't think you're going to have to buy anything else. You're going to be able to do everything right on that machine.
No, it's inconvenience. Inconvenience in milling part. Lathe, it's okay. For whatever I need, I can use. But milling part, that's why, I mean, this thing is absolutely marvelous, that mill. It's horizontal, but so what? In Poland, I had something like a horizontal mill. It was also the center, which actually could do so many things at once. And this one was approximately 7,000 kilograms. It was 14,000 pounds heavy. So I got friendly with this stuff. Now this is very small one. And to exit for 80.
C2WGB. You know, what are you basically going to need a milling machine for? What do you intend to do with that that you're not going to do on a lathe?
Okay, well, milling machine. You have your pipe or your tube. Then you have to mount it somehow. That's one thing. The second thing is you want to drive, let's say, the coils, like these two secondary coils. You need to drive them on that big, huge pipe. The huge pipe cannot lie on the table. It has to be somehow lifted, it has to be elevated. And then another structure is, if I want the ferrite to be movable somehow within this pipe, that's why I wanted to have the inner pipe that would actually bind all of these rings together, and the outer one will be actually the one that is only carrying on the coil. So you need to have something steady structure that you can drive the ferrite in and out or change the coils and stuff. So now it's no longer going to be something like on a table and tangling. For that, you need the mill to make the structure. Back to you.
Okay, well, I thought you were going to put it on a board and make brackets to hold it up and make a threaded rod for you know, like those things you put. I didn't understand why you need a milling machine. If you're going to actually mill metal to make your mounting blocks and all that stuff, okay, then you're going to need the milling machine, sure.
Well, it is not necessarily metal, but I have purchased from ABS a big block, 12 inches by 12 inches, and it is approximately 2 inches thick. I can just measure that. That would be, 157.45. So close to 2 inches thick. Now, this big stuff I could use if I have a milling machine. I can make a cut it on few horizontal pieces and make a nice bracket. It's not metal, it's not affecting, but it's big and strong. Now, at a certain point, on this bracket, I have to mill or make the hole, so it can hold the cylinder. Or maybe I need to make another rod where I can hold, where I can put the rod in with the slider, or something like that. The milling machine is of necessity. Back to you.
Okay, because for large holes in a block like that, you could use a trepanning tool to cut the holes. But milling machine, yeah, it'd be easier. With all, if you're going to need a whole bunch of different types of things to machine, of course, you don't want to do that by hand, start sawing by hand. No, that's crazy. And if you got the end mills and the cutting mills to do it, the milling machine will sure make it a lot easier for you.
See, I was working on a milling machine. The problem with the milling machine is that if you have the milling end, and the milling end is, let's say, half an inch thick, and then you want to make the circle in that big block, which would be, let's say, 4 inches in diameter. You can put in the software the circular or interpolar cutting trajectory in it, and it does that. You don't need to do anything else. But if you have a regular manual mill, now try to follow the curve. Almost impossible, but still.
Oh, absolutely, because we used to do that, but it was on, the milling machine did not move, the tool stayed where it was, the bed rotated, and to do that, you're right, and it takes several procedures, and it's one mistake, and it's wrong. If you have it computer operated, perfect, it'll cut it exactly what you want. You get the incremental movements, it won't bite hard, take a little time, but it'll do it, it'll be perfect.
Right. So, if I have a chance to buy $40,000 machine that is priced for $4,000 for $1,500, well, nothing more that make me happy. You know, what I love the most is I'm getting something that is extremely, extremely expensive for pennies, but this.
Oh, no, that would be a very good buy. It would be crazy not to buy it. The only thing is, you'll probably have to rent one of those small trucks from U-Haul when you get out there. It would probably be cheaper for you to fly out there, rent a truck, drive it back, and leave it here.
I don't know how much it's going to cost me the ticket. Because if I have to spend for the ticket as much money as I spend for the gas, it's a 14-hour drive. 14, let's say, it takes me 20 hours with the sleep. Now, I already sent the questions. Can I, but what I can do is, my problem is move. My truck is that I, my, the bell, the canopy, the not canopy, bed that is at the rear is not removable. I cannot remove that stuff. But you have your van doesn't have, it's like empty from the rear, right?
That's correct. It only has the two seats in the front. The whole back bed is open.
Well, that would be perfect. That would be perfect. I mean, there is no way in the whole world that this thing is 2,500 pounds. There is no way. Absolutely. I was comparing it to very, very heavy, huge cast iron machines. This thing is supposed to be 10 times big to weigh that much. Back to you.
Yes, because my van couldn't hold 2,500 pounds. There's no way it'll do that. But that thing, I think that weight is a mistake. And if you said it's only, I think you said it's 4 feet, I think that would fit in my van.
Me too, Wild.
Go ahead.
Actually, I'm barely in range. Just a thought, there is a member in the Climart Club who has started a side business making metal fixtures for hams, for the ham market specifically. He has a full metal shop. He's making brackets and, you know, various stuff that you would need for antenna work and things. you might want to get in touch with him in the short term if you have any projects that he may have a shop good enough to do for you.
Okay, and what is his call sign?
Back to my office tonight. I'll get to his contact info.
Okay, so when you get to the office, give me the contact to this guy, and you can email me, and my email address is on QRZ.com. Okay, John Picasso.
Yeah, Wes, what you have to do is get some measurements that are pretty accurate, and we'll measure the van up and see if it fits in there. That might work. That'd be very good.
Yeah, I believe it's the guy who is selling is not the guy who has this, what is this machine he's on. It's just the auctioneer who got it for penny or for nothing when he was buying the stuff. And he doesn't even know, and also, it's not even the man. I mean, don't get me wrong, I have nothing against women. But the name of the person is Lisa. Lisa, you know? I had to send twice the same questions, and then when I finally realized that it's Lisa, I started to construct these questions the most possible silly way. I mean, I'm sorry using this word, stupid way, so the woman can understand it. And then I've got the answers. Back to you.
Oh, I was going to say maybe the name is Leslie, but to say Lisa, okay, no, that's a girl. Yeah, well, I'm sure she doesn't know. She probably doesn't even know what the hell she's selling.
No, if she runs the business on eBay, then she knows what she's selling. She doesn't know what she's selling, but at least she has a rough idea. You know what I'm saying? But telling me that this unit, I mean, I can say, okay, let's approximate the wage for 500 pounds. That's okay, that I can understand. That would be plenty, but not 2,500. She said approximately. I asked her about the dimensions a few times, and she was giving me a baloney. You know what I'm saying? It's just when I'm talking right now, it looks like I'm very much ignorant to women. I'm not, but this is not the women word. Back to you.
Well, I think the only restriction you have in the van is the height, getting it in the back door. That's probably because I know I could put a piece of plywood in there, but the height I'm not sure of. I don't know if it's 4 foot height. That might be a problem. But we can measure it if she can get some accurate measurements. You know, like take a picture of it with the ruler next to it so we can see how high it is. We'll read the ruler, you know?
You know what? I'm going to send you the picture of it. Hold on. Let me get into that. Okay. It's gonna be looking big on the picture, but then there is another picture showing how small it is. And, okay, just a moment. You got it.
Okay, I'll go to the computer, let me look.
I send you another one. This one is with the all of the answers for the emails. And dimensions. It shows dimensions as well. inches tall, 41 inches wide, and 33 inches deep.
Amateur Radio News Line report number 1731 with a release date of Friday, October 15, 2010, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, One. The following is a QST. Ham radio plays a role in the Chilean mine rescue. Radio Amateurs of Canada announces a survey for the hobby's future. Scouting celebrates the 2010 Jamboree on the air, and a historic college amateur radio station is back on the air. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1731 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now reporting from Mississippi, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
Amateur radio appears to have played a key supporting role in the rescue of 33 miners trapped beneath Chilean soil for 69 days. Bill Pasternak, WA6IPF, is in the newsroom with the latest.
The saga began when the mine in San Jose, near the city of Copiapó, collapsed on August 5th and ended on August 14th when the last miner rose to the surface at 00:55 UTC. And while news reports heralded the success of the rescuers, loss was a small but important contribution made by that nation's radio amateurs. But Chilean hams were there throughout the entire ordeal, doing what they do best, that being another line of needed communication after being called upon to provide it. According to a report posted on the IAR Region 2 website by Ramon Santoyo, XT1KK, it was the Radio Club de Chile and the Radio Club de Copiapó that provided communication support between authorities and emergency equipment operators inside the San Jose mine complex. Chilean hams also provided liaison between the families of the trapped miners and authorities at the Rescue Coordination Center in Copiapó. Perhaps the most important job performed by the Chilean radio amateurs was to establish an amateur radio communication system into the mine complex itself. The ARO reports that some 80 members of the radio club Copiapó installed the equipment and then manned it with club volunteers beginning way back on August 5th when the mine collapse first took place. This radio system, together with mobile police stations, hospital, and fire battalions, kept everyone abreast of all the needs and urgent requirements of those involved in the rescue work. Though the hams of Chile were not shown on the front page of the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune, nor were they featured on shows like NBC Nightly News, their part of the story has been low-key until now. Nonetheless, it was a job well done by amateur radio volunteers, giving of themselves, as hams do, when their skills and services are needed. And for radio amateurs, that's what public service is all about. From the newsroom in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, for the Amateur Radio Newsline. Don?
Until the news release by XE1KK, it wasn't known that ham radio was involved in this mining rescue. Seemingly following in the footsteps of the Radio Society of Great Britain, the board and executive of the Radio Amateurs of Canada is asking current, past, and future potential members, as well as amateur radio clubs, to provide thoughts and recommendations on the future of the hobby in that nation. This by responding to a set of questions posted to the organization's website by October 20th. Responses will be considered at a meeting at the end of October to develop a vision for the future of Radio Amateurs of Canada in the 21st century. In addition, they will be establishing a two-year operational plan for 2011 and 2012. Canadian hams wishing to take part in the survey should take their web browser to tinyurl.com/2C8L8WM and follow the instructions found there. As reported last week, the Radio Society of Great Britain has launched a major survey of all United Kingdom radio amateurs. The objective of the survey is to gather as much information as possible on 21st century amateur radio operation in that nation. The latest issue of the International Amateur Radio Union's Region 1 Monitoring System newsletter is asking hams to use its new online intruder logger and intruder alert system. to file reports of unwanted users of the ham radio band. Those providing input should include source, time in UTC, and mode being used. Short-time intruders should be sent to the intruder logger. More on this, including online reporting forms, can be found at the URLs provided in this week's printed amateur radio newsline report. And around the world, the 2010 Scouting Jamboree on the air is underway as we go to air. For one group, it's the 20th year it's taken part. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, has the rest of the story. Mark.
They call themselves the Spark Lodge, and they're based at the Musser Scout Reservation outside of Green Lane in Montgomery County in suburban Philadelphia. Rick Blank, WB3 BSA, is president of the organization, which actually is a scouting venture crew with its own call sign, K3BSA. He says it's a special weekend, not just because of the 20th anniversary of JOTA operations for the group, but still being around to offer young people a program that uses amateur radio to teach international brotherhood is special.
A lot of our contacts have been over in Europe or in South America. When we get a station that we can talk to and put the kids on in a faraway place, that's really a special thing because the kids get a real good charge out of that.
He credits the longevity of the group to Philadelphia scout officials who have been supportive of its efforts over the years and a dedicated group of ham operators.
Well, it really is a combination of all the time and effort that the volunteers have put into building, the enthusiasm that the scouts get about radio and communication, you know, being out there in the camp and nice facility that we turned that building into is really kind of special. We refer to the building now, it used to be called Coos Cabin. We now call it Spark Lodge, and Spark for us stands for Scouts Practicing Amateur Radio Knowledge.
Blank says Spark Lodge has a very functional setup.
We have two high-frequency operating positions. Those two operating positions, we can use single sideband and digital modes, Morse code, and PSK 31 or phase shifting. And some of the other operating positions, we have VHF, UHF, where we can use a computer to send and receive email through packet radio.
Wires serve as antennas, he says, and wind and ice storms do occasionally play havoc with those. In addition to JOTA, Blank says Spark Lodge also offers a year-round program of radio demonstrations at the camp, and on special weekends provides a program of radio merit badge, as well as computers, electricity, and even says it's branching out into railroading. But Blank says JOTA will always be the premier event for Spark Lodge.
Those that can participate are scouts of all ages, Girl Scouts, Brownies, Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts, Adventurers, Explorers. They can all come up and take part in the activity. It's the international scouting event, the largest event in scouting each year, with nearly 500,000 scouts participating worldwide.
You can learn more about Spark Lodge by going to their website, www.k3bsa.org. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V in Philadelphia.
And lest we forget, if you happen to hear this week's newscast before the 2010 Jamboree on the Air comes to an end, please get on the air and say hello to the scouts taking part worldwide. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the W9HSY repeater serving Madison, Wisconsin. An amateur radio operator from San Jacinto, California, who had admitted making a series of transmissions threatening the lives of local police officers and fire department personnel, has learned her fate. Amateur Radio Newsline's Bruce Tennant, K6TZW, has the details.
On Friday, October 8th, 29-year-old Irene Levy, KG6CEY, pleaded guilty to 7 charges, including interference to the Hemet, California Police and the Riverside County Fire Department. A judge in the city of Murrieta sentenced her to probation and gave her credit for the time she spent in jail since her arrest last spring. She was also ordered to undergo psychiatric care. As previously reported here on Amateur Radio Newsline, last May 3rd, police closed in on KG6CEY just seconds after she made a final transmission on a Hemet police frequency using a commercial HT. Investigators from the Hemet Police Department as well as Cal Fire said that the unauthorized, random transmissions were made from Levy's mobile home in San Jacinto. Her radio transmissions, which included bomb threats, were monitored on frequencies used by the Hemet Police and the Riverside County Fire Department, and that they went beyond nuisance calls. At that time, Hemet Police Sergeant Mark Richards was quoted by the Press Enterprise newspaper in Riverside as saying that Levy disguised her voice as a man and made references to the deaths of police and firefighters and made bomb threats. He said that some of the transmissions came during a CAL FIRE search and rescue call, a major traffic accident, and a brush fire. Richard's report says that the transmissions began May 1st and ended in the early morning hours of May 3rd. He said in the report that the direction-finding equipment had helped locate Levy, who, in one of her transmissions on May 2nd, suggested, quote, police would never find her, unquote. Richard's report said that during the raid on her trailer, police seized 11 radios, 7 scanners, radio frequency lists, computer equipment, and other miscellaneous radio gear. He says in the report they also seized Levy's technician class amateur radio license, showing it had been issued in September 2009. On her now-removed QRZ.com bio page, Irene Levy had claimed to have a General Mobile radio service license, but the call sign attached to it is actually registered to her husband, Michael Levy, KE6ALD. She had also claimed to have monitored the Keller Peak repeater as well as Hammett repeaters. Levy also said in that now-gone QRZ bio she was active on Citizen Band radio prior to getting married and described herself as a CB-er at heart. The Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Bruce Tennant, K6PZW in Los Angeles.
But Irene Levy's problems may be far from over. At this point, the FCC has not yet entered into the matter. If it does and decides to cite KJ6DEY, she could face a fine, a license suspension, or even a hearing to determine if she should be permitted to continue as an FCC amateur radio licensee. Listeners of two South Florida radio stations got a surprise when their Christian and classical music stations were interrupted with what authorities called rap music and profane language. On Thursday, October 7th, authorities found out why. According to investigators, an unlicensed broadcaster had set up shop on a frequency between two licensed stations. The Broward County Sheriff's Office says the illegal signal came from a Lauderdale Lakes home where an aspiring rapper had attached a laptop, audio mixer, and computer. This gear, in turn, fed a transmitter and an antenna. The station called itself Trap Radio, was allegedly operated by Michael Rod. Rod has been charged under Florida state law with unauthorized transmission or interference with public or commercial radio. At airtime, it's not known if the FCC has become involved in the case. A Christchurch, New Zealand man who ran a hobby radio station has been fined $4,000 and had his equipment confiscated after boosting his transmitter power to a level that interfered with air traffic control. According to news reports from down under, Jeffrey Knowles operated low-power non-commercial radio station Sounds FM, which has now been shut down. When it was on the air, it legally broadcast music during the day and streamed BBC programs at night to the Shirley, Pompanui, and Parkland suburbs in Christchurch. And in the past, it had earned Knowles a Community Service Award. Now, the 48-year-old Knowles has admitted to Christchurch District Court he interfered with the air traffic control radio frequency. This by broadcasting with excessive power using equipment that had a fault with its overall frequency stability. Knowles also admitted to a charge under the New Zealand Radio Communications Act of transmitting outside the terms of his license. As a result, his broadcast caused the closure of an air traffic frequency for 24 hours last February by interfering with transmissions between aircraft and the control tower. Under New Zealand law, Knowles Station is permitted to run as a low-power FM hobby station, but in making its case, government prosecutors argued he had increased the power to reach up to 45,000 listeners. The New Zealand Radio Broadcasters Association reported to the court that they were losing advertising revenue because of Knowles Station taking potential listeners away from commercial stations. Defense counsel Clayton Williams said Knowles accepted the equipment was faulty and did not oppose it being forfeited. He did, however, dispute the concerns about the amount of power used. In rendering his decision, Judge Gary McCaskill said Knowles had been warned that his broadcasting gear was faulty, but had done nothing about it. He then imposed a fine of $4,000 as well as court costs of $130 and a solicitor's fee of $250. It's unknown if Knowles will appeal. And while a version of this story circulated on the internet blogs identified Knowles as being a ham radio operator, a check of licenses shows that this is not the case. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration has issued approximately $20.45 million worth of public telecommunications facilities program grants so far this year. A total of 126 projects have been funded. Of those, 72 grants worth $9.9 million are to replace equipment at public radio and television stations, while 30 grants for some $4.6 million will extend new public radio services. 16 digital conversion grants were awarded for television, representing just over $4 million. 3 digital conversion grants totaling a little over $202,000 were awarded for radio. With the radio grants, stations in Arcata and San Diego will be able to purchase digital production equipment. Also, a station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana will be able to establish an HD radio multicast service. Altogether, the new radio service grants will extend service to a potential 500,000 people and provide additional service to almost 1.2 million other listeners. 38 projects totaling more than $2.8 million will replace urgently needed equipment at public radio stations. One of these is a $20,407 grant to Cumberland Communities Communications Corporation. It was awarded on an emergency basis to replace an antenna that suffered catastrophic failure as a result of a lightning strike. While it's short warning, word that the Canadian Section Emergency Task, or SET, is coming the weekend of October 16th and 17th. Radio Amateurs of Canada says this is a great opportunity for Ares groups to practice the delivery of assistance to Canadian municipalities and served agencies. More information is online at www.rac.ca. A telemedicine communication system based on a modified version of the Bluetooth wireless protocol can transfer patient data almost four times as fast as conventional Bluetooth. This without intermittent connectivity problems, according to a paper in a forthcoming issue, the International Journal of Medical Engineering and Informatics. A team led by two researchers at CSG College of Technology in India have devised a dedicated embedded system that uses the short-range Bluetooth wireless networking protocol to connect patient data to the network and then on to the healthcare provider. This avoids the problem of trying to ensure that a viable connection between monitoring devices and the internet or cellular phone network is maintained constantly. The team has already demonstrated the specific application of this technology. This one involved the transfer of patient medical images, CT scans, to the healthcare provider's personal digital assistant device as an example of how Bluetooth might work for telemedicine. The team says that tests with these images of approximately 1.5 megabytes can be transferred using their modified Bluetooth system in just 120 seconds, as opposed to the 400 seconds for standard Bluetooth connections. Mac McCormick, WB4MAK of Atlanta, Georgia, has made available a web-based 80, 40, and 20-meter SDR-based receiver. We gave it a try from the Newsline office. Its tuning is very responsive, and the first station we came across on 20 meters turned out to be a guest operator at the ARRL headquarters station, W1AW in Newington, Connecticut. Take a listen.
W5CJB. My wife's initial. This is W1AW. The handle is Dick. Denmark, India. Charlie King. Go ahead.
Roger, roger. Dick, the name is Jim. Juliet, India. Mike from San Antonio, Texas. You got a good signal coming in here.
Okay, Jim, fine business. You're about an S2 here. Not a lot of strong signals, but we are copying you 100%. Over.
Roger, roger. Okay, we'll let you get back to others. There are people trying to get a hold of you. Thanks for coming back to us. You have a good day. W5CJB, San Antonio, 73.
We also heard W1AW contacting W6RO on board the Queen Mary Ocean Liner that's docked in Long Beach, California. But due to band conditions, we only heard the W1AW side of contact.
My business, Larry. We talked to you folks before from California there. W6RO on the Queen Mary. W1AWN, the handle is here.
The WB4MAK SDR receiver can be a handy tool to check out radio propagation to the southeastern United States by anyone with a high-speed internet connection. You'll find it online at WB4MAK.com. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. Last week, Fred Bobby, W8HDU, reported on a report detailing problems being faced by audio preservationists in keeping alive man's history and sound. This is digital files corrupt or simply fade away, mainly due to the instability of optical storage media. In other words, CDs and DVDs that many thought would last hundreds of years are starting to lose data in a decade or less. Now, Fred is back to detail the steps that the Library of Congress and other archivists are taking to ensure that audio's past will not be lost.
New training and college degree programs for audio archivists are essential to improve preservation. Currently, no universities offer degrees in audio preservation, although several offer related courses. The study also calls for legal reforms to enable more preservation. A hodgepodge of 20th century state anti-piracy laws has kept most sound files out of the public domain before U.S. copyright laws were extended to sound recordings in 1972. The study found that only 14% of commercially released recordings are available from the rights holders. Later this year, the library will debut a national jukebox online after securing a license to stream sound recordings controlled by Sony Music Entertainment. The more copies of historical recordings that are out there, the safer they are. The study also calls for changes in copyright laws to help preservation. As it stands now, copyright restrictions would make most audio preservation initiatives illegal, the author wrote. Dwindling resources also hamper preservation efforts at many smaller libraries and archives. The study also calls for more coordination among preservationists to prioritize efforts and develop techniques that can be used by institutions with smaller budgets. I'm Fred Bobie, WAHDU.
If you find this topic of interest, much more on it can be found online at www.loc.gov. In ham radio space-related news, word that an amateur radio satellite ground station has been opened at the Challenger Learning Center in Oregon, Ohio. According to WAMSAT North America, the station will stimulate students' interest in math and science and will allow youth-oriented contacts with the astronauts and cosmonauts on board the International Space Station. The Challenger Learning Center will provide lesson plans and activities on amateur radio to go along with the new ground station. It will also use the system during camps and workshops to demonstrate ham radio contacts to space. The station at the Ohio location came online Monday, October 4th. More is online at tinyurl.com/29LJN70. An update on the Arisat-1 project. Word from project manager Gould Smith, WA4SXM, that the former SuitSat-2 flight package was shipped from Orlando, Florida to the Johnson Space Center in Houston and has arrived. From there it goes to Russia, where we'll have the cursed equipment added to the space frame. It will then be made ready for transport to the International Space Station next January. Deployment into space should take place during a spacewalk slated for February 2011. In DX, keep an ear open for W5JON operating as V47JA from the Calypso Bay on St. Kitts from October 20th to November 10th. His hillside location will overlook the Caribbean Sea and Atlantic Ocean. He plans to be active on 160 through 10 meters, including 60 meters. To a cell to W5JON at his callbook address. The planned de-expedition to Jarvis Island has been postponed. The team has announced that due to the time required to establish the rules for amateur radio operation in the refuge, the last selection date, and the lead time required to schedule and prepare the MV Braveheart, the expedition has been postponed 1 year until November 2011. Leaders say that November remains the best month to visit Jarvis Island from a propagation standpoint, with the largest combination of openings predicted to Europe on both 160 and 80, as well as on the 12 and 10 meter band. ON5JV and ON6AK will be active portable EA-8 from Tihoko Bajo on Tenerife Island between November 26th of this year and February 23rd of 2011. Operations will be on 40 through 10 meters during their evenings using CW and SSB. QSL via their home call signs, either direct or via the Bureau. PA0RRF is active as 9M2MRS from Penang Island and will be there through April of 2011. Operations so far has been mainly on 20 and 17 meters CW. QSL to Richard Smeets, PA0RRF at his Netherlands callbook address. VE7RSV will be operational from Bruton Island during the W/VE Islands contest on October 23rd and 24th. His activity will be on all bands using SSB only. QSL direct to VE7RSV at his address on QRZ.com. And time is running out to work VU3DPZ as AT10BP. He's the communications manager of the 29th Indian Expedition at the Antarctic Maitri Base Station. He and his team have less than 2 months remaining on the island. QSL direct only via I1HYW. And finally this week, Arizona State University Club radio station W7ASU is back on the air after a long hiatus. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley at KI7UP has the details.
W7ASU dates back to the 1930s and actually is one of Arizona State University's oldest student clubs. According to Nicholas Ratke, KC7MOD, the current president of W7ASU, there was a station on campus with some breaks until about 15 years ago. The club station was in the old technology building with two towers and multiple antennas on top of the building. That building is now Psychology North. Unfortunately, a series of events contributed to the club's going into limbo. First, through misunderstandings, the towers and antennas were removed and destroyed during two separate re-roofing projects. second, most of the club members graduated, and the advisors retired, leaving no one to lead the group through change. And finally, because of tight space on campus, the club's room was given to an academic department. Kretke, who is a doctoral candidate in computer science, explained that around 1997, a new group of students revived the club and sponsored one major event per semester. They would put an antenna on the third floor balcony of the student services building with the station out in front. They also tried doing a few events at club members' houses using their personal ham radio stations. Attendance at these events was abysmal, with a common complaint being that members couldn't get to events off campus. In February 2007, the student media offered the club a space in the Matthews Center, and the hams obtained permission to put up a temporary antenna for several events. But the club still needed a permanent antenna to operate, and that was not to be at Matthews Center. In June of 2008, university space planners suggested that the club think about using several rooms in the community services building where they could be able to put up an antenna. Soon after, the family of Richard S. Jubet Jr., WB7CTK, who had been the club faculty advisor in the 70s and 80s, donated a tower and antenna and other equipment from his estate. Now, his shack set up and a tower in place right beside the community services building, W7ASU is, as they say, ready to roll. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP, not far away in Scottsdale, Arizona.
The club still hopes to keep its room at Matthews Center to set up equipment to remotely control the station in the community services building. The full story of the rebirth of the Arizona State University Radio Club station, W7ASU, is online at tinyurl.com/W7ASU. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. Please don't forget that in association with the Newark Amateur Radio Society that we are currently conducting a survey to determine where these weekly Amateur Radio Newsline reports are replayed on the air. If you're a bulletin station that transmits these weekly newscasts or a listener who has the following information, we need you to supply to us the call sign of the repeater or bulletin station making the transmission, the frequency where it can be heard, the time and day and days of the week it's broadcast, the time zone and the estimated audience you think it has. Please email that information along with your name and call sign to arnschedule@gmail.com. Once again, that's arnschedule@gmail.com. And as always, we thank you for your assistance in the survey. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ICF at the editor's desk, I'm Don Wilbank, AE5DW in Picayune, Mississippi, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2010. All rights are reserved.
Co-connecting.
Node number 9126.
The time is 1:23 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2BL repeater. Next tonight at 8:30. The W2BL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, W2BL Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2BL Repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Next tonight at 8:30, this is the W2BL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Next tonight